From St. Mary's to Carlisle, Hermitage to Harrisburg, this is Lincoln Radio Journal. On this edition, it was 12 days late, but Pennsylvania has a new state budget. No new taxes, the rainy day fund was not raided, but accounting gimmicks were used. Stephen Bloom, Rebecca Euler, and Matthew Briette are here for a Capitol Watch roundtable discussion. And the proposed development of new data centers has generated public opposition bordering on hysteria. I'll have a town hall commentary on why the concerns are overblown. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. We'll get to our Capitol Watch crew in just a couple of minutes, but first, news headlines from patownhall.com. U.S. Senator Dave McCormick this past week hosted major players in the defense industry and Trump administration officials for a two-day Pennsylvania Defense and Innovation Summit. The event was held at the U.S. Army War College in Carlisle, with President Donald Trump joining in a roundtable discussion on concerns that the nation's stockpile of weapons has been dangerously depleted by the military action in Iran. Pennsylvania companies are major producers of the parts that go into the manufacture of munitions. After Governor Josh Shapiro dissed the Great American State Fair by refusing to stock the Pennsylvania Pavilion, U.S. Senators Dave McCormick and John Fetterman stepped in and recruited a wide array of Keystone State organizations and businesses. They filled the booth with Pennsylvania-made products and information. The grassroots effort paid off. The Pennsylvania Pavilion was honored with the Best in Show Award. The fair was held as part of the 250th anniversary celebration of the signing of the Declaration of Independence. Governor Josh Shapiro is simultaneously running for re-election as governor and for the Democratic presidential nomination. He is finding the national political waters to be far choppier than those in the Commonwealth. An article in Axios recently took Shapiro to task, saying that many center-left Democrats are, quote, looking for a national leader to go toe-to-toe with the party's rising socialist wing. For now, at least, that is not Shapiro, end quote. Recent primary victories by so-called Democratic Socialist candidates have created a rift in the party, leaving more moderate Democrats scrambling to counter the far-left trend, which threatens to upend party campaigns in competitive congressional districts. Meanwhile, the campaign of Republican gubernatorial nominee Stacey Garrity got a boost this past week as Florida Governor Ron DeSantis headlined a fundraiser for her in Philadelphia. Garrity hailed DeSantis as, quote, the best governor in America. Read about all things Pennsylvania at patownhall.com. A new $50.8 billion 2026-2027 state budget has been approved by the legislature and signed into law by Governor Josh Shapiro. Numerous accounting gimmicks were used to balance the budget, and associated issues, including the regulation and taxing of skill games, were not addressed in the agreement. Our Capitol Watch crew is here to sort through all of this. Stephen Bloom of the Commonwealth Foundation and Rebecca Euler from the Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association are joined by Matthew Briette from Commonwealth Partners Chamber of Entrepreneurs. Steve?
Welcome to Capitol Watch, where we keep our eyes on what's happening under the Capitol Dome for you. I'm Steve Bloom from the Commonwealth Foundation, and I'm joined today by Rebecca Euler, President and CEO of the Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association, and Matt Briette, CEO of the Commonwealth Chamber of Entrepreneurs. Welcome to Matt and to Rebecca.
Good to be here, Steve.
Good to be with you, Steve.
We're glad to have you. We're going to jump in and talk about the Pennsylvania state budget. And it's a topic that we deal with at least annually. Every year in Pennsylvania, we have to, by constitutional requirement, pass a balanced budget for the funding of the Commonwealth and all the things it does over the course of a year. And it becomes, as those who've followed it many, many years, like Matt and Rebecca, you get a sense of the history and the process, and it's complicated and confusing. There are opportunities for mischief and troublemaking, as well as sometimes some smart moves made from time to time. I wanted to kind of get both of your takes on this budget that just got enacted into law. I've heard it referenced as a status quo budget or a kicking the can budget. I think one of the things that jumped out at me is what they really kicked is accountability when they kick that can, push that down the road. But I'd like to hear from our panelists. And Rebecca, if you might give your first take on your hot take on the budget.
Well, I think both those descriptions that you use are sort of status quo and kick the can are both apt. I think they both sort of make sense. The one thing that this budget did nothing to do was address the structural deficit that we have, and we talk about often on the program here, is we absolutely spend more every year here in the Commonwealth than we take in tax money. And this budget did nothing to address that. It did not raise taxes, but it also did nothing to address any of the long-term spending either. So it didn't take any money out of the rainy day fund, which I think is a responsible choice. And it didn't increase funding as much as the governor had proposed to increase funding at the beginning of the year. It ended up with 3.7% increase, which is lower than the governor had proposed. But it did use some interesting accounting tricks as well, which maybe we can get into. But, you know, it just didn't really address the long-term issues that we have. So that's kind of my first take on it. I'm sure Matt has more to say.
I think, you know, the bottom line is that you've got a Democrat governor who's running for president. You've got a House holding strong with their 102 majority versus 101 Republicans and have been able to, you know, be in lockstep.
Surprisingly, they've held together.
So, and then you have a Republican majority in the Senate of a 27-23, which really means you can only lose two Republicans in any vote because a tie goes to the lieutenant governor, who is a Democrat with Josh Shapiro. So it is a, you know, there's tension there over who's going to give and take here. So at the end of the day, I think this budget deal, it's significantly better than Shapiro's proposal, over a billion dollars that he wanted to spend that we didn't have. I mean, he was banking on revenue from legalizing marijuana and skill games, which neither of those things happen. But there's no way you can say that this is a fiscally responsible budget. I think Rebecca touched on some of those things, in particular when apparently government can operate on an 11-month year where the rest of us have to budget for 12 months in our families. And these are some of the accounting and budgeting gimmicks that make this a financially irresponsible budget. And it was, you know, look, this happens when we have election seasons. Folks want to get out of town, get back to campaigning. They just want to get these things done. And sadly, that means for the taxpayers that we don't have kinds of fiscal responsibility that we have to do in our own households. And Harrisburg can, you know, play some trickery with the budgeting gimmicks. We've seen this all the time. I mean, when you're talking, Steve, I was thinking back, boy, back when Ed Rendell was governor, I think our general fund budget was about $10 billion. Yeah. I mean, it's amazing how quickly we've gone. And now we're talking about over $50 billion. And that's not the total spend, right? When you add in local and federal, we're well over, I think we got to be close to $120 billion. I haven't paid that close to this, but it's a lot of money, a lot of taxpayer money flowing around. Yeah.
Well, thanks, Matt. I want to just run through a few of the summaries that our organization, the Commonwealth Foundation, put together just to kind of set some topics out there that either one of you may want to weigh in on. But the good news is that the deal avoids several of Shapiro's and House Democrats' worst ideas. It does not raid the rainy day fund. It does not include broad-based tax increases. It rejects Shapiro's cruel and chaotic cuts to scholarships for low-income students. It does not include combined reporting. Does not include a mass transit bailout or a minimum wage increase, and it maintains the scheduled reduction of the corporate net income tax. The bad news, the budget still spends too much, includes a large increase in public school spending with no accountability, and does not expand school choice, and it fails to address the state's long-term spending problem or make Pennsylvania more competitive. So really a mixed bag. How does that stack up compared to other budgets? Again, Matt, you've been watching this since the early 2000s, I believe.
Yep.
Rebecca, you've been at this a fairly long time
about
as well.
About the same amount of time.
How does this kind of fit in the scheme of other budgets you've seen and how this is different or better or worse?
It's middle of the road in the sense that we've had some really, really bad budgets, whether it was Rendell raising personal income taxes early on in his administration. I also think that we could have done a lot better. As I noted, they're competing interests. Frankly, the Democrats have it easy, right? They can say, we want to buy everything in the world, spend all the money that exists in the world, even if it's not coming into the government coffers. And then you're going to have to winnow that down. And then they're going to always be able to claim some victories. I mean, some of the things that frustrate me, I guess probably the thing that frustrates me the most, because this is a bipartisan effort, is the amount of money that we keep chucking into public schools. I mean, we are spending over $24,000 per student in Pennsylvania. Most people don't realize that. But what are we getting for it? It might be worth it if we were seeing academic performance off the charts, but we're not. And we keep sending more and more money to schools that don't perform. We've got schools that have zero proficiency in reading and in math, and we keep throwing more and more money. That's the frustrating thing, because I think in this budget, we spent almost another $1 billion, I think almost $900 million additional into public education. In fact, over the last 5 years, and I think I got this from Commonwealth Foundation, over the last 5 years, we've increased public school spending by 41%. Now, inflation has gone up a lot, but it hasn't gone up that much. And I think that these are the things that frustrate us in particular when we're talking about how we're spending money. We're not opposed to it, but what are we getting for it? And I think when we look at the public school system, we are not getting a good return on our investment, yet lawmakers, Democrats and Republicans alike, continue to throw more and more money into a system that is not serving the kids that it's supposed to be serving.
Yeah, it's become a shameful disaster for the kids. They're literally, as you said, not meeting the basic proficiency standards. They have this complex organization set up to educate children across the Commonwealth, and the one thing it's not doing is educating children. It's wallowing in its own failure.
Well, and this is the other frustrating part, is that I think the first time in 10 years that we haven't expanded educational options for kids, the Education Improvement Tax Credit, the Opportunity Scholarship Tax Credit. Shapiro hasn't opted Pennsylvania into the Federal Scholarship Tax Credit. Yet there are kids sitting on waiting lists, tens of thousands of kids that want to get out of these schools that aren't working, that are spending $24,000 plus in many of these cases. Yet we didn't expand that. So to me, that was a big failure to the kids that are trying to get a better education, yet can't because they don't have the resources. And so we pump another $900 million into public schools, and the kids that are wanting to get out are left with nothing. They're trapped in those schools that are spending a lot, but they aren't delivering results.
You are listening to Capital Watch.
Well, I will say, looking back at past budgets, I think that this one, like Matt said, I think it's pretty middle of the road, but there have been some, you know, sort of forward-looking budgets that really take a look at how to improve Pennsylvania's business climates in the past. This one doesn't do that so much. But I do want to look at the positive, and that is, and you mentioned this already, is the phase down of the corporate net income tax. And that is still included in here. So that's something that's been happening over the past couple of years, from one of the highest tax rates in the nation down to, it's going to be 6.99% in 2027, which brings us almost to middle of the road. It's getting us down there to be much more competitive with other states. And also maintaining increase of the corporate net operating loss deduction as well. Those are things that we had started a few years ago, and it's been a bipartisan agreement that the state is not competitive for attracting businesses here. So I think that's a really positive thing that we have this bipartisan agreement now and have been able to agree that these incentives to bring Pennsylvania into line and to be more competitive with other states and with our business climate is really positive. So the fact that that was able to be maintained, even amidst all the other, you know, moving pieces of this budget, I think is a really positive thing.
Well, so. And I think, Rebecca, you had mentioned this earlier of not raiding the rainy day fund. Now, for folks that don't understand, this is money that is set aside for when we have a crisis, a financial crisis, a natural disaster, or something that truly is out of our control, right? And that there are reserves there in order to keep government functioning. We're certainly not in a rainy day situation where money should have been raided. Yet what Shapiro wanted, like half of that, if I recall correctly.
Yeah.
I mean, he
$4 billion.
And those are one-time funds, right? So he could use them this year, but then you've built a budget on one-time funds and you're going to have to go find it in the next fiscal year. So stopping that from happening, because Josh Shapiro, he's a short-timer, right? He's running for re-election, but I guarantee you January 1st of 2027, if he's re-elected, he's going to be going to New Hampshire and Iowa and South Carolina because he is starting the campaign for president in 2028. So he really doesn't give a rip about Pennsylvania's financial situation in future years. So kudos to the Republican Senate for saying, you're not going to raid this because what that's going to cost taxpayers in the future to backfill recurring revenues, because those are not recurring revenues. So I think that that was one of those good things of saying, no, it's not a rainy day. Don't touch those billions of dollars. Save them for when we truly need them.
And it's a great point, because what it does is it forces a policy choice. So if you're going to increase spending to that extent, then you have to choose what tax are we going to increase,
right,
or what funding are we going to decrease. It forces them to make a policy choice. So if you're committed to this long-term spending, then you have to make a decision of how you're going to pay for it. So the fact that that's not included in here is a positive.
Indeed.
For sure.
I mean, it doesn't mean we're not going to have difficult financial decisions next fiscal year, because
yeah,
I think we noted how they're budgeting on an 11-month calendar year rather than what the rest of us have a 12-month, that's going to create some fiscal challenges in the future. You can't continue kicking that can down the road. It's going to catch up with you.
Another thing that this budget does is utilize the couch cushion money that is held by the state, sometimes even been argued that it doesn't exist. It's been pointed out and talked about for probably about 10 years or so. And some people say there is not even such a thing as the couch cushion money.
Well, these are like reserves in various departments, or that they've been overfunded, right, in some ways that year after year, and they don't spend it all. And so there's money sitting in various departments, I think mostly executive departments of the governor's office. And so forcing them to spend those monies, those are tax dollars that have been paid over the years. That's right.
Literally sitting in escrow accounts.
And what was the number? Was it $1 billion or so? Or maybe it's less
than that. Well, no one seems to know the actual full total, but research I've seen, $5.3 billion even.
Yeah.
Using large chunks of that, applying it to this budget, is part of what ended up creating the vehicle that could be passed without the raising of any taxes.
Well, we know that those monies exist in public schools. They have their own reserves.
Account.
I think that it might be that $5 or $6 or $7 billion dollars that as they continue to raise people's property taxes, they're sitting on monies. And this is where that accountability aspect.
Right, because the government, if nothing else, they should have the obligation not to collect more in taxes from the taxpayer than can actually be used.
Right.
Why, if they have a reserve, they should announce it. They should say there's extra money here. We're going to refund it. We're going to reduce the rates for next year. But instead, they keep squirreling it away. But as I said, about 10 years ago, when I was still a member of the General Assembly, we had a task force we put together of other members just trying to understand, what is this thing? Is there really couch cushion money, or is it not?
And we— Wait, you don't have full visual on that?
It's real. We talked to multiple folks over the years who said it's not real. In these last 2 years or 3 years now, it's been used. It's real. And it's happening. So at least that's a step in the right direction to use that rather than force new taxes right away, which the budget would have done absent that couch cushion money.
And that's good, but wouldn't you agree that that's also something that shouldn't continue to happen year after year, right?
Yeah.
And it has continued to happen for the past few years.
Yeah, and that's what, you know, again, I always try to relate this to what a family or a business does, is that they've got all these subscriptions that they're not using, right? You don't watch this TV show anymore. Why do you have Apple TV? This is a discussion we had in our own house. Like, why are we paying for this subscription, right? That government should be doing the same thing. If you're not utilizing these resources, why do we still have a fund to pay for fax machines? We don't need that. I don't know if that exists, but Oh, I've been into some of these office buildings that they are sitting there on the table.
Yeah.
So another area that I think is really important and perhaps overlooked by some, this budget did not include cuts to education scholarships. Now, that's a simple statement. There's a lot of complexity behind that. The major educational scholarship school choice structure in Pennsylvania is an EITC. And this, in the last several weeks before the budget was enacted, the Democratic House majority really carried out an attack on the viability of the EITC program. They proposed and moved legislation that would literally gut the program. So with the mobilization of school choice supporters and students and families and lawmakers and grassroots all across the state, we were able to beat back that challenge. But what normally has happened in the past, in the last several years, is there would be an expansion of the program. This time, because of that attack, we saved the program intact, but it did not receive any additional funding, which is an unusual twist. And similarly, the last couple of cycles, some of the state charter schools have been having these unwanted cuts thrust upon them by the government as well.
And I think, as you note, Steve, it's really the Democrats driving efforts to gut programs that kids, particularly in their districts. I mean, these are kids, mm-hmm. these are poor kids in Philadelphia and other parts of Pennsylvania that are utilizing EITC, Education Improvement Tax Credit, to have a scholarship to attend a private school, a religious school, or a charter school that they're able to access. Yet they're being attacked by the very people who's supposed to represent them and trying to deny them these opportunities. And I mean, they were going after. They said they want to make these things not exist. And today, I think.
Go away and go away forever.
We've got 100,000 plus kids on using EITC scholarships across the Commonwealth, and they want to take that away from these kids. And it's ludicrous to me. Of course, it just shows you where their interests are. It's with the teacher unions, not the kids at the end of the day. But that's what's at play. And I think that that's a real threat for us in Pennsylvania, because the Democrats are looking to get a trifecta in government, meaning we talked about this earlier. We had Senate Republicans holding strong on this budget. They want to flip the Senate so that you have Democrat, House, Senate, governor, as well as the Supreme Court. And they haven't had, Democrats have not had that since 1994. And if they capture that this November, I guarantee you we're going to see those cuts on the chopping block and will probably happen very, very quickly. So this is what's at stake at the end of the day when it comes to policy.
Thank you so much for being here. Where can folks reach you, Rebecca?
They can find the Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association at pmta.org.
And Matt?
And go to Commonwealth Partners website at thecommonwealthpartners.com.
Excellent. And you can find me at commonwealthfoundation.org. For Rebecca, for Matt, we'll catch you next time on Capital Watch. And now, a town hall commentary by Loman Henry.
Back in 1999, concern bordering on hysteria gripped America and the world over the unknown impact on digital infrastructure from the arrival of a new millennium. Doomsday forecasts prompted many to stockpile water and food in the event system failures would significantly disrupt daily life. When the ball dropped in New York's Times Square at the stroke of midnight on December 31, 1999, the planet was neither plunged into darkness nor chaos. The feared technological meltdown failed to materialize. In retrospect, the hysteria was unwarranted. A quarter of a century later, a new technology hysteria is playing out across Penn's Woods, this time centered on the construction of data centers. Fear of developing technology has collided at the intersection of misinformation, conspiracy theory, and NIMBYism. Pennsylvania is on the cusp of becoming a major host to data centers. In addition to fulfilling the obvious technology needs, data centers spin off a wide array of benefits, including high-paying construction jobs, family-sustaining permanent jobs, and significant contribution to the local tax base. Additionally, many of the electronic components used to equip data centers are manufactured right here in Pennsylvania. The focus, however, has been on the perceived negatives, most of which are, at best, greatly exaggerated, if not outright false. As a result, citizens have packed local government meetings to rail against the siting of data centers, and lawmakers have rushed to propose a wide array of reactionary measures. Data centers make everyday life possible. Cellular phones, social media, GPS systems, the internet, medical records, the systems that control the electric grid, inventory at your local grocery store, photos of your kids and grandkids stored in the cloud, are all housed in a data center somewhere. Chief among the misinformation being spread about data centers is they will cause rising electric rates in surrounding communities. Pennsylvania is part of the 13-state plus District of Columbia PJM power grid, so a data center built in your municipality isn't going to have a local impact. Data center construction is not responsible for the rapidly rising cost of electricity. That is the fault of government, especially Pennsylvania state government. In a new report issued by the National Taxpayers Union, Joshua Schubert pinpointed the cause. Quote, from 2019 through 2024, regulatory uncertainty over the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, REGGIE, shrank Pennsylvania's proposed generation pipeline by 62% in cumulative pipeline volume compared to the prior six-year period. Developers who were building power plants at the fastest rate in the PJM region stopped proposing projects. Three large natural gas plants were canceled, the state's largest coal plant and a nuclear reactor closed, end quote. This past suppression of generation capacity is why data center developers simultaneously construct new generation facilities and/or invest in existing infrastructure upgrades. In Pennsylvania, for example, a new natural gas-fueled power plant is being constructed in Homer City, which will not only provide electricity to a new data center, but add to the grid supply. The shuttered Three Mile Island nuclear power plant near Middletown is being restarted to generate power for a proposed new data center. Data center opponents also cite water supply as a concern. In addition to the fact water is not exactly a scarce resource in Pennsylvania, consumption of water by data centers is relatively minimal. The Committee to Unleash Prosperity compiled an infographic showing that more water is used annually in the United States to spray on golf courses and irrigate watermelon patches than is consumed by data centers. There is also a concern over where in a community a data center should be located. Virtually every municipality in Pennsylvania has a zoning code on the books. Data centers should be treated the same as any other business and therefore be constructed in the appropriate zone. They will not pop up in the middle of your housing development. A valid point brought up by data center opponents are tax breaks and subsidies for data centers. Government, federal, state, and local, should not be in the business of picking winners and losers. All too often, government puts its thumb on the scale. Data centers, like all other businesses, should succeed or fail based on market forces. The bottom line, while prudent consideration of data center construction in accordance with local zoning laws is necessary, misinformation-driven hysteria should not be allowed to derail the continued development of this critical component to our nation's infrastructure. With a Town Hall commentary, I'm Loman Henry. If you miss hearing Lincoln Radio Journal on your favorite radio station, audio of our complete program is available on our websites, LincolnRadioJournal.com and LincolnInstitute.org. For 31 years, Lincoln Radio Journal has been heard on public affairs-minded radio stations throughout the Commonwealth, including WNTE-FM in Mansfield, WEEU-AM in Reading, along with WVYC-FM in York, Pennsylvania. The Lincoln Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, including the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, the Allegheny Foundation of Pittsburgh, and the Houston Foundation of Coatesville, all of whom have helped to underwrite the cost of this program. Lincoln Radio Journal is a trademark of the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. From the Frederick W. Anton III Center in Harrisburg, I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to Pennsylvania's most widely broadcast public affairs radio program, Lincoln Radio Journal. Plug into the pulse of Pennsylvania. Thank you.
We'll be right back.